Today's cases will be called as previously announced, and the times will be as allotted to counsel. The first case today is number 25-1373, John Doe versus Sarah Smith et al. At this time, would counsel for the appellant please come to the podium and introduce herself on the record to begin?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Louise Aponte for the appellant, John Doe. With the court's permission, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, you may. And before we start, let me say after the first two cases, we're going to take a short 5 minute break, and then we'll hear the two other cases. For you, it doesn't matter, but whoever's around there. Okay, well, let's proceed. Thank you.
Your Honors, this is an exceptional case where Mr. Doe, a private figure, seeks to enforce a unilateral NDA that was specifically designed to protect his identity, his minor daughter's identity, and information relating to his lottery win from the media and the public. He's now faced with a catch-22.
The essence of your request is that we have a carve out of public access to the courts for lottery winners. These NDAs for lottery winners is not unique. A lot of lottery winners are resorting to this, and you're asking for a carve-out. I mean, what you say it's exceptional, but what makes it exceptional?
Thank you, Your Honor. What makes this case exceptional is that the central issue is protecting Mr. Doe's identity from the public. And as this court held in Kravitz, it is a... Well, Your Honors...
It's unique as to him. It's not. It wouldn't be unique as to every lottery winner who opts to keep their identity undisclosed, and that's getting more and more common.
Respectfully, though, as this court stated in the United States versus Kravitz, it is a balancing analysis. And so Mr. Doe asks this court to vacate and remand the trial court's order denying him trial closure and continued pseudonymity for two important reasons. Again, he's faced with a catch-22 where if he's forced to proceed by name to a public trial, his identity, his daughter's identity, and their highly personal information will be revealed, exposing them both to the severe risk of irreparable harm.
One of the things is, can you separate him? Because I haven't seen this in the briefs argued, but the daughter's still a minor.
Yes.
So is there a separate request because the daughter's a minor for her identity or versus him, or it's both or nothing?
Well, it's both, Your Honor. The language of the NDA and the specific purpose of the NDA was to protect both Mr. Doe and actually Ms. Smith, the appellee in this case, and their minor daughter from the risk of irreparable harm.
What's the irreparable harm?
The irreparable harm is the specific concrete threat in this case. Mr. Doe submitted an affidavit early on with his motion for pseudonymity at the very beginning of this case, alleging the threat of kidnapping, extortion, physical harm, psychological trauma, unwanted attention.
Have there been specific threats as to this Doe, or is it just a general threat to all who might come into the similar circumstances as he's come into?
Our original motion for pseudonymity did mention one or two specific threats, although I would say that this court in Doe versus MIT did cite to the Ninth Circuit case of Doe versus Advanced Textiles, where the court there held that threats obviously do not have to be acted on. Thankfully, they have not been acted on in this case, but the standard is that a reasonable person would believe that the threat is a reasonable one and could actually take place.
Is that the same situation? In this case, technically any music star or famous actor can end up here, and they can have small children. Children might be involved also, and then isn't that kind of like a similar situation? Because if we do it for Doe, our president would probably have to apply, and it then applies to the rich and famous, or rich who don't want to be famous, versus the average person who then has to proceed openly.
Doe submits that this is not the typical case of a rich and famous person who seeks to avoid bad publicity or seeks pseudonymity specifically for economic reasons or mere embarrassment or reputational harm. It's also not the case where a rich person wants to protect their minor child from mere embarrassment. Here again, the record reflects specific threats that we believe under this court standard in Doe versus MIT, the standard is the reasonable fear of severe harm. The district court, one of its errors in this case was not assessing the harm to Mr. Doe and his minor daughter, and instead dismissing the first and second paradigms under the grounds that it could apply to the entire tier of rich and famous persons. Doe submits that, in fact, under the standard, under the MIT totality test, they should have assessed the harm to both Mr. Doe and his daughter without comparing them to a hypothetical group.
Are you saying that the MIT test applies across the board to both the closing of the trial and the pseudonymity, or?
No, no, and I'm happy to address the.
So what should we look at? Let's set aside pseudonymity for a minute because there's a little bit clearer paradigm there.
Yes.
What about closing the trial? What do you say we should look at to determine that?
We would ask this court to look at the balancing analysis in U.S. versus Kravitz. And turning to the issue of trial closure, in Kravitz, this court held that the public right of access is vibrant but not unfettered, and that there are important countervailing interests that may defeat access. Now, the district court did assess the Kravitz framework, but it short-circuited the analysis. At first, it addressed, it declared that closure was a non-starter, and it stated, quote, a publicly filed case is no longer a private matter. And it prioritized openness without properly assessing factors which Kravitz held weigh heavily against public access. In this case, the privacy rights of Mr. Doe under the NDA, the third-party privacy interests of his daughter, which are central to the NDA, and the traditionally private nature of the protected subject matter of the NDA. In this case,
is this traditionally private? I mean, that seems to me to be a little bit different than most cases where that's been referenced, where it's something like sexual assault or something of a different nature than just coming into a substantial amount of money.
Or a trade secret. I mean, we recognize that.
Courts have recognized that, in fact, the presumption of public access can be defeated in cases of trade secrets, national security, and where there's a compelling privacy interest. And so here, based on the NDA.
The privacy interest is because of the NDA, which is a private agreement between Doe and Smith.
That's correct, and they are private figures. Kravitz did state that traditionally private subject matter includes family affairs, private financial information, and potentially embarrassing conduct with no public ramifications. That's exactly the information that we have in this case.
How does this fit with the rules of civil procedure, which seem to pretty bluntly say the presumption, at least, and it doesn't even talk in terms of presumption, is about being an open court?
Certainly, the federal rules support the strong public presumption, but they don't mandate access and they don't mandate proceeding by actual names. If they did, the standards in Kravitz and MIT would be unnecessary. And the First Circuit and certainly other circuits have recognized that it is a balancing test. And we would point to in the trial closure issue, the district court specifically failed to weigh under Kravitz the nature and degree of injury to Mr. Doe and his daughter, the sensitivity of their information, and how the media intends to use it. Kravitz, relying on the Supreme Court case of Nixon versus Warner and the Second Circuit case of the United States versus Amadeo, cautioned courts not to let public access become a vehicle for improper purposes, either to promote public scandal or to cater to a morbid craving for the sensational. But that's precisely the risk of an open courtroom in this case.
Why?
Because unfortunately, Your Honor, to date, the media coverage of this case has been extensive and sensationalized. If the past is any indication, a public trial that reveals Mr. Doe's identity will be a massive assault on his and his daughter's privacy and safety interests. Ms. Smith's brief notes that Schadenfreude sells, but this type of media exploitation is exactly what Kravitz warned should not be indulged in the name of monitoring the courts.
Let me ask you also, the NDA, does that have I assume it doesn't have an arbitration clause, correct?
It does not. But we would submit that the district court improperly penalized Mr. Doe for litigating and not arbitrating. In fact, Mr. Doe has a right to litigate. He has a right to seek injunctive relief under the NDA. And arbitration certainly is no guarantee of confidentiality.
One question for you as to the interplay of your two arguments. If we were to disagree with you on whether or not the trial should be closed or open, does that mean that the pseudonymity would no longer really provide any meaningful relief? How would that work in your
view? Unfortunately, as a practical reality, that is the case. That we submit that both trial closure and continued pseudonymity is necessary for irreparable harm not to be realized. If there's a closed trial without pseudonymity, unfortunately, a closed trial is not a closed ecosystem. If there's only one leak to a reporter, the harm can't be undone. What's published can't be unpublished. And the flip side is true, that if you have an open trial with pseudonymity, the minute that there's testimony that relates to background, location, employment, unfortunately, the way our internet age is, it would be very easy to identify Mr. Doe and his daughter. I mean, the court did propose the solution of referring to his daughter by initials, but unfortunately, as a practical matter, once Mr. Doe's identity is revealed, hers will be easy to obtain as well.
You mentioned the media, the press, that the press should not get any of the information. So, in essence, if the court were to order the trial to be closed and then pseudonymity, the media, the press, nobody, you know, will know whatever happened or even the gist. Everything's totally. That's what you're suggesting that happened? Because it'd be like a private. It'd be like a private trial in federal court.
No, Your Honor, because certainly the docket would remain open, but obviously would refer to the parties by their pseudonyms. The ruling of the court certainly would be a public matter. Again, just redacted.
Let me ask, maybe not a trial, but there's probably going to be summary judgment practice. And then are you going to ask, will the summary judgment motions be kept sealed? I assume that would be the next thing. And because it's, you know, it's all the information from depositions and from anything else. And that's those motions. Then there's going to be discovery. You've been asking the court that all the depositions and everything else be kept totally secret or kept in the court's vault. So the court, you know, in essence, what concerns me is you're using the federal court system, which is a constitutional system, to have a private litigation. And, you know, maybe the parties should have, you know, could have considered again the non-disclosure in the arbitration clause. There's 100 other things that could have perhaps been done.
I mean, even the cases you cite had limited closure. It wasn't complete shutdown of the courtroom.
That's correct. I do see that my time is up, but I would like to address Judge Helpe and then Judge Thompson's questions.
Address hers first, then you can address mine.
Okay. Absolutely.
My seniority.
Judge Thompson, absolutely. There is a lack of precedent when it comes to complete trial closure. There are a few cases that we did cite in our brief that relate to partial closure. I would say, though, that rightly so. I think that's consistent with the idea that there is a strong public presumption. But I would submit that the court has been open to the idea that exceptional cases may warrant trial closure, and that exceptional does not equate to never. So, in fact,
wait, those cases weren't cited below. Is that correct?
In our brief.
To the district court. I don't believe they were cited below, so you're skirting with waiver.
Your Honor, we did cite to them in our appellate brief, but that's correct, not below. That's correct. But again, I believe the courts that are open to partial closure do recognize that it is a balancing decision. And Judge Helpe, what I would submit is that, especially under Doe versus MIT and U.S. versus Kravitz, again, Doe is not asking for this court to step outside what it has already ruled is a balancing analysis under those two cases. I would specifically mention that the third paradigm of MIT is certainly relevant here, where disclosure is the very injury litigated against, and anonymity would be necessary to forestall a chilling effect to Mr. Doe and future litigants like him in this exceptional case.
Let me ask you one last question. Did before argument today, the counsel for both sides appear before the circuit settlement council, or that hasn't happened in that case?
That has not happened.
And let me ask, would your client be amenable, and again, you can answer in your rebuttal, would your client be amenable to that? And that's a question for the other side as well. You can tell us when you're done arguing, but that's another option, that if it's settled by settlement council, then you don't have to go through all this. And it again, just proposing an alternative. So, okay,
Certainly, we would be amenable to that. I would say the reason why this issue came up is because the district court asked us to brief it at this time, recognizing that there is a catch-22 for Mr. Doe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, would counsel for the appellee Smith please introduce himself on the record to begin?
May it please the court, Peter Brand for the defendant. First, the trial court did not abuse its discretion in denying an unprecedented motion to close an entire civil trial for an alleged breach of an NDA. Second, the trial court did not abuse its broad discretion in denying an unprecedented request to allow the adult parties and all of the family members, which is all but one of the identified witnesses in this case, to use pseudonyms at trial. And what we heard this morning is, in order to succeed in what the plaintiff would like to do, they need to prevail on both of those claims, and we submit they cannot succeed on either one. Turning first to the court closure, no court cited, and we heard again this morning, has allowed a complete closure of a civil trial. And certainly none of the examples of even partial closures involved an NDA.
I just need to pin down. So you're saying that you don't object to pseudonyms, but you do object to closure.
No, we object to both of them, because we just think the law, when we look at the law under MIT dealing with the pseudonyms, we think that they did not satisfy the standards. It certainly is not a case where the district court abused its discretion. Remember, it's a broad discretion, as this court said in MIT, to deal with the pseudonym. And this court also, in dealing with the pseudonym, said it may make a difference as you get closer to trial. And the notion that you could have a trial where every witness, there's like a dozen folks who are listed as possible witnesses, would all appear using fake names, and you could have a trial with a jury trying to figure out credibility and the like, we don't think that they could do that. And so we submit that they did not satisfy either the standard under MIT for pseudonyms, and they certainly didn't satisfy the standard under Kravitz to close the entire courtroom for a civil trial.
Two questions for you on pseudonymity. If the first is the potential harm to the daughter, what is your view of the record as to what they have shown as to the potential for harm from that particular consideration?
The most important thing where I want to start is Judge Woodcock found that there was not going to be a harm to the daughter. So they have to show that there was clear error in that finding. And the evidence in this record just isn't there, because the judge said, if needed, that neither side listed the daughter as a witness at trial. And the judge made clear that he would allow her to be used initials or pseudonyms, so for the minors that would allow.
But that might be worthless protection, given where we stand today. If it's so simple to find out who that daughter is, so what does the record show as far as the potential for harm to the daughter?
Yeah, what was the threats that your brother counsel was referring to?
I was trying to recall what those might have been, and it let's just say it didn't spring to mind as to what the alleged threats were, but that And I don't recall, but the judge with regard to threats generally, and I'll come back to Judge Dunlap too, with regard to threats generally said that there really wasn't evidence that, of that. And more importantly, unlike the other examples, either in the pseudonym, primarily in the pseudonym area, where someone can not protect themselves, they're a sex abuse victim, they're, you know, mental illness, what have you, that by virtue of this wealth, you actually can take steps to protect yourself against that. You can build a moat around your house and you can have security, et cetera, et cetera. So that addresses that in our view, and that was the judge's finding. There really is no evidence dealing with the daughter, but that comes out because the judge, the judge rejected that there would be harm, and also said that he would allow the daughter to be used for a pseudonym. Is it perfect? Perhaps not, but it is that, you know, that's, we can carve that out because that was not something that was on the table. We're talking about all the witnesses.
Let me follow up then on a separate issue as to pseudonymity. It seems to me that the district court took into consideration two of the paradigms that we've set out. Is it an abuse of discretion to not consider the chilling effect on future litigants? It doesn't seem to me that the court took that into consideration. What does that mean for our analysis here?
I would suggest that the court did take it into consideration. It said, you know, the plaintiff refers to the so-called catch-22, but the very next line is that was the reason they have this problem is because of what they did. That is, that they chose to have enforcement in a court, unlike an example where you could have private enforcement in a private arbitration. And so the chilling effect is that future litigants will have a different answer to Judge Helpe's question of, well, there's no arbitration provision. The answer is there should be. And if they were really concerned about it, that's the solution. And the judge did take that into consideration. So I would submit that Judge Wicott took into consideration all three paradigms, found against the plaintiff on all three, and that's why there's no pseudonym.
Is private arbitration an adequate remedy? Basically, what we would be saying is you have to not avail yourself of the court system.
If your principal concern is the privacy, then you have many, many more options available to you in creating a system through a private arbitration. If you really want to take advantage of what was referred to earlier as our constitutional system, that is, we're going to go to a federal court, which is presumptively open under the rules of civil procedure, and where in open court is where you get testimony. And if you want to take advantage of that, it comes at some cost. And so that it's not that you can't do it, but you have to understand you're giving up something, which is true of a lot of things in life, where if you really want to have the ability to go to a federal court with all that comes with it, there are some things that also come, which is it's an open court.
Counsel, let me ask you the same question I asked opposing counsel. Would your client be amenable to appearing before the Circuit Settlement Council? Because again, this can be resolved by Settlement Council. Then, end of the story. No need to further litigate this.
Well, without obviously getting into the details, let's just say that both sides have at least made efforts in the past to discuss. Is there an off-ramp to this particular case? And one of the things that we have in the district domain, as you probably know, is we have an excellent magistrate judge who does a lot of great settlement conferences, which was my goal originally in this case. We have not been successful. Never say never.
You've appeared before the magistrate judge for settlement.
We have not. I proposed it, but we have not done that.
But now counsel said she'd be amenable, her client, to appearing before the Settlement Council for the circuit. So my question is, would you be amenable? And again, if it's not resolved, then we rule upon it.
I would have to think about it. I certainly don't want to denigrate the First Circuit settlement procedures. I have never found them to be as successful as the ones I've used in the District of Maine. That's just my experience.
I guess the tricky part about sending it to settlement is that the newspaper still has an interest which might not be
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of your question.
I said the tricky part about sending it to settlement is that the newspaper has an ongoing interest in disclosure.
Presumably. I mean, we're obviously about to hear.
Yes, we'll hear from them in a minute, yes.
But I think the bottom line from our perspective is that we think this case is easily resolved as a matter of law. And I think that that will lead, as we heard this morning, unless the plaintiff is able to prevail on both of those claims, I think it's going to lead to a short-circuiting of the rest of this case, which would satisfy, which is one of our objectives.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, would counsel for the Appley Maine Trust for Local News please introduce himself on the record to begin?
Yes, Your Honors. Thank you very much. Eugene Volokh for Appley Maine Trust for Local News. As this court, contending, I think, two members of this panel, pointed out in Doe v. MIT, the openness of the courts, including the openness of the names of the parties, is fundamental to our system for many reasons. And one of the most important of which is the public's power to supervise the courts, oversight of judicial performance, and therefore the public confidence in the court's work that stems from openness. Here we have a situation where there may be a trial in which the plaintiff is likely one of the richest people in Maine.
Well, is it fair to say that the newspaper isn't interested in going to settlement?
Yes, Your Honor. Although, of course, the underlying settlement of the parties' cases is up to them. But yes, absolutely. We would like to see a decision from this court, and we would like to see the names of the parties revealed, because so much has already happened in the lower court.
So you want us to get rid of the pseudonymity even if it doesn't go to trial?
Yes, Your Honor, and as a general matter, pseudonymity is something that has to be present throughout the naming of the parties has to be present throughout the entirety of the case, but especially at trial. So if we have a situation where one of the richest people in Maine is suing someone, probably Mike, our senses of modest means, that's the very sort of thing where the public might scratch its head and say, why is this happening in secret? It's especially so if it becomes, to our knowledge, the only ordinary civil case that would be litigated, to our knowledge, in the history of American civil justice. Certainly, extraordinarily unusual thing. Why? As Your Honor pointed out, it sounds like just because this person is a lottery winner, or perhaps this person is super rich. Of course, there are security concerns that those who are very rich have, although, of course, they also have the means to help alleviate those concerns much more so than people who are more modest.
Do you have an understanding of the threats that they are alleging occurred?
Your Honor, so in addendum 51 to 58 is their motion that the district court denied that led to this appeal, and that motion, as I read it, is quite general. It talks about the security firm advising that there are various challenges and harms, which sound like the sort of general challenges and harms that children that rich people and their children will sometimes face. We are unaware of any concrete threats. It's possible that somewhere introduced to trial under seal, the trial court under seal, and we do not have access to that. Perhaps this is something that could be answered in rebuttal by plaintiffs. But we think that this is just the general concerns that rich people face. And we don't want to downplay those concerns. There are real concerns, but they cannot justify a rule that says, well, if really rich people sue, at least under certain circumstances, well, they get special pass. That is...
ask you about the relief that you're seeking, because something that you said a minute ago raised a question in my mind. Are you seeking relief that would, undo the pseudonymity that has been maintained to this point, or are you only asking that if it moves forward to trial that pseudonymity would no longer apply? And the reason I ask is, say that the parties decide that they will ultimately settle the underlying matter without any further proceedings in court. Are you seeking that the names be released in any event, or are you only seeking relief in the event that you go to summary judgment, trial, and the like?
Your Honor, so that is an issue that the district court has not confronted. I think one question that the district court might have to face at that point is whether documents that, say, had been sealed under the circumstances of the pseudonymity that had been present at the time should then be unsealed. That is not a question that is currently facing this court, and that is also therefore not a question that I've consulted with my client.
I thought the district court unsealed. I thought part of the appeal was that the district court ordered that the record be unsealed and denied pseudonymity and closure. Am I misunderstanding?
Your Honor, I'm embarrassed to say I don't recall that being the case. It is possible that I may have overlooked that. To our knowledge, the current appeal is from the decision to deny pseudonymity going forward. Your Honor, we will look at the record and, if necessary, supplement our briefing with an answer to your question.
Also, let me ask you from the press's perspective, let's assume we were to rule in favor of the plaintiffs in, you know, as to both issues. How would this in any way create maybe a slippery slope for the media moving on forward?
Your Honor, this would become a standard remedy that that litigants would seek in a lot of cases which have facts that may be much starker and much more appealing in many ways than the ones here. Right now, I think litigants say, look, we can read Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 43. It says quite categorically that testimony shall be given in open court, at the very least a total closing that never happens. But once they see it happens in this case, if it does, then in that case, I think they would say,
tomorrow it could be a future star player for the Red Sox or Celtics who's a gazillionaire and is getting divorced and has three minor children. Oh, I got the perfect case here, and there'll be another one, and that's what would be happening probably in every time, you know.
Yes, Your Honor, exactly. And there would also be the concern that this would be disproportionately asked for by people who are wealthy or famous or otherwise specially situated. And again, I think that would undermine public confidence in the court's work.
And if it's given to the rich, then our oath is, you know, to the rich and to the poor. So the poor also would have, you know, would there be like eventually no public trials?
Yes, Your Honor. This would be, perhaps I don't want to say that there would not be any. In some situations, people wouldn't care. But yes, that would be a radical change to the way that our court system operates. Your Honor, if I could just respond to one question that you had asked about the chilling effect. In fact, any time somebody wants confidentiality, there may be some chilling effect that openness provides. Doubtless, there are actually some cases that are probably not filed. Your Honor, may I finish the sentence or the response to your question? Some cases that would not be filed because there's a knowledge of open court. But that cannot be sufficient. That possibility that a case might not be filed in the future cannot be sufficient. And that is why when this court talked about the third paradigm, when it after talked about chilling effect, it actually said it typically arises in particular narrow classes of cases involving intimate issues such as sexual activities, reproductive rights, and the like, and then this unusual situation where there's basically a Fifth Amendment privilege against incrimination at issue. So that paradigm, I think, needs to be cabined to those kinds of cases.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
3 minutes for rebuttal.
Please reintroduce yourself on the record to begin.
Louise Aponte for the appellant. Your Honor, just addressing Mr. Volokh's last point regarding this court's standard in the MIT totality test. In fact, the court made clear that there's certainly no hard and fast rules when it comes to which cases warrant pseudonymity. In fact, it did not limit cases that simply involve bodily autonomy. Rather, it went beyond that to say that civil cases come in a variety of shapes and sizes. And so to limit pseudonymity just to bodily autonomy cases
Would you say that, you know, the family relationship between the plaintiff and his daughter has its own autonomy, which is analogous to bodily autonomy in a sense?
Certainly. And as to the issue of The second paradigm and the substantial harm to the minor daughter if Mr. Doe is identified. I would point out that the appellee, Ms. Smith, did agree in the language of the NDA that disclosure of Mr. Doe's identity could cause irreparable harm, not only to him, but to his daughter, if the media and public seek to discover information relating to Doe's assets and personal information, which is why we believe that privacy, safety, and identity concerns intertwine in this case to make it that exceptional case.
What's the nature of the concrete threats that you're referring to?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. In our motion for pseudonymity at the beginning of this case, and we did move that not only Mr. Doe should proceed by pseudonym, but Ms. Smith as well, and both have proceeded to by pseudonymity to this day. The harms that we set forth were certainly psychological harms to Mr. Doe and his daughter. They've been engaged in regular counseling due to feelings of isolation and alienation that are typical when it comes to this sort of situation. There was also reference to a person who had been sending creepy, rather threatening correspondence, not sure that it was, you know, getting to the right place, but obviously it was of concern to Mr. Doe. So I would also mention that as to the argument that under MIT, Mr. Doe is wealthy enough to mitigate any harm to himself and to his minor daughter, respectfully, mitigation resources are not the test under MIT. And as the Ninth Circuit held in the case cited by MIT, pro hoc remedies do not make a litigant's fears less reasonable. So it's our position that the district court erred by improperly reasoning that his wealth should be a factor.
But if he can ameliorate the threats, then the question would be, are his fears reasonable?
Yes. And again, we would say that the standard set forth in the Ninth Circuit case that MIT relied on said that, yes, the test is not whether the harm can be ameliorated, but rather whether a reasonable person would consider that the threats are credible and significant to take into account. And for all of these reasons, we do ask this court to vacate and remand so that the district court can properly apply Kravitz and MIT.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes our